Accession number 15327, Reel 2.
Mr. Angelbeck, Reel 2.
Well, these anti-aircraft crews were to come down to us, and we were then told, you get back to the UK as best you can and good luck. Well, as you can imagine, we were a bit apprehensive by this, but we were very fortunate because of the low weather, the low cloud, and the poor visibility. So, in fact, the last two or three days, while we were waiting for the Germans to come and bomb us, we had a most extraordinary time, because the army were being evacuated. And they were very keen to get a lot of their equipment back if they could. So they came down to the quay and said, in those days, each officer had his own little runabout, which was, about a bit bigger than a mini today. You know, they were an Austin 7 type of thing, which was their private little car. And they came down and said, would you be prepared to take this back to the UK for me? So we said, oh, yes, bring it down. Just bring it down to the quay. So the quay, then about 2 days before we were due to go, was absolutely lined with these little cars. And I remember Norton Motorbikes was another one that a lot of people had. And we'd go along these, and we'd pick one that looked in good nick, and we put this on the foredeck, and the crew had quite a lot of the Norton motorbikes. They were good 500cc things, and they were put down in the magazine, we had ultimately about five of the cars on the foredeck. And must have been about 10 motorbikes down below. But having got them all stowed away, we then had a marvellous time, because there was a huge dump of aviation fuel, and we could just go and help ourselves to this. So we filled these cars up with aviation fuel and then raced around Harstadt. And we'd crash. If we crashed one of these cars, it didn't matter, because we'd go and get another one. And I mean, we went absolutely mad. And funnily enough, indicative of the how Harry Tate things were then, there was this huge dump of aviation fuel. It was just left for the Germans. They didn't even set fire to it or anything. It was just left in its canned state. But the last night was quite incredible. The forces in Harstadt were pretty Catholic lot, to say the least, because you had French Foreign Legion, you had Poles, you had all kinds of British people, and Navy and Air Force and so on. And on the last night, when it was quite apparent that everybody was going, the NAFI threw the gates of their their sort of where they kept all their stuff. They threw it all open. And so all these blokes got in, and they got the barrels of beer and barrels of rum and all kinds of things. I mean, it was absolute free for all. You could just help yourself, you see. And these barrels of liquor were set up in the main street of Harstadt. And it was really rather like, I would imagine, a pirate's orgy must have been. Everybody was as pissed as a fart, you know, and it was quite some party. And then the following day, we left and had a very painless journey home. We didn't see anything. It was fairly thick the whole way home, and we just ultimately got back to Aberdeen, and we were allowed to use the cars and the motorbikes for our leave, which we were given. And then we handed them in to the army when we'd finished our leave.
Had the Northern Wave detected any U-boats during the Norway campaign?
Not. I don't think I had no knowledge of any that were up there at all. I mean, as far as I was concerned, it was a very trouble-free episode. We'd just been on patrol, and that was that. We were bombed, but we weren't hit.
Did you stay then with the Northern Wave after the Norway campaign?
Yeah, I'm just trying to think what happened then. I think I stayed with Northern Wave for a while, and then we were moved to Northern Ireland, and I was then appointed first lieutenant of a much more modern trawler than the Northern boats, called the Zalma. Was the CO was a former barrister by the name of Firth, and we were based in Londonderry, and in those days we just used to escort convoys out as far as 25 West, which we didn't go the whole way over. We just went to 25 West and then came back again. And these Western Ocean convoys were interspersed with a trip down to Gibraltar or a trip to Iceland. And they rang the changes a bit as to where we went. And I did that for a year or so. And then this man Maurice Firth was an extremely ambitious and very competent bloke, and he was appointed to a flower class corvette. So I was hooked up with him before the naval officer in charge. In those days, I didn't regard myself in any way as a navigator. I'm not mathematically inclined, and I disliked anything to do with figures. But we'd always managed to get by, in spite of never using any sophisticated form of navigation. With Maurice Firth, he made me realize that a lot of bullshit goes a long way, in that we'd been flogging the Western Ocean for a year or so, and neither of us, I certainly wasn't capable of taking a good sight. And I don't think he was, and I never saw him do one. But what we used to do is, he had a great technique, is when we were with a convoy, it was fine, because the commodore of the convoy hoisted the position of the convoy at noon each day. So we were able to get a proper position. But if we got detached in any way and were on our own, we just used to use dead reckoning would go by that. Well, even in those days, it was surprising how often you'd run into independent merchantmen. And so old Firth's technique was to flash up the merchantman and said, "Could I have a check position, please?" At which they would send their position, and we knew that because they were merchant service, that could be relied on. And so we would then move ourselves maybe about 100 miles and start again. Well, then, when that didn't crop up, we were also dependent upon the old Sunderland flying boats, and the anti-submarine, the beginning of the anti-submarine air arm. In the signal book, there was a marvellous signal which we sent to the aircraft, was WAI, which is, where am I? And invariably the reply we got was WFO, which was, we'll find out. And the airplane would then go back and make a landfall, identify where we were, and then he'd come back and tell us where we were. So again, we would move it. So you can see it was a bit Harry Tate. I think the worst, when we were coming back, if we hadn't had any of these, we were always a bit apprehensive about where we were going to hit, because we were normally came in at the Butt of Lewis, which is the north end of the Hebrides. Well, the worst that occasion we had was we came in at just about the mouth of the Shannon, which, as you can imagine, was quite a long way south. But it was all right, and we didn't hit France.
Did you run into the enemy at all on these Western Atlantic?
No, we personally didn't. I mean, there were several occasions when the convoys were attacked and ships were sunk and so on. But as far as we ourselves, as individuals are concerned, we were extremely fortunate. I mean, we never had anything. I mean, I had a very very quiet war, really. We just were escorting. We never sank a submarine. We never, as far as I know, we never came across one.
How did the Vizalma compare with the Unilever trawlers?
Oh, it was much more comfortable. As CEO, that's another interesting thing. See, there were grand ships to be in if you were a reservist, as I was, because the general attitude of the powers that be was that, it's only a bloody trawler. So if you dropped a clanger, it didn't really matter. But at the same time, they were big ships. I mean, normally in peacetime, they'd fished off North Russia and Greenland and so on. so they were very big and very comfortable ships. My cabin, for example, I got command of this when I was 24. My cabin was about 12 by 10, mahogany panel, very comfortable. I had my own private full-length marble tile bathroom, loo and wash basin next door. I used to get hard line money for that. But, I mean, my quarters were a jolly sight more comfortable, I'm sure, than many a destroyer captain. Vizalma had been, in fact, laid down at the beginning of September 1939, war then broke out, but they then carried on building her to the original peacetime specification, except she was converted straight away to an anti-submarine ship. But it meant she was really a very modern ship, and they were very comfortable and very safe.
How did your promotion to skipper come about?
I just went with Firth, and we saw the naval officer in command, and he asked me a few questions, and I told a few lies, and Firth told a few lies, and in the end he said, right, I'll give you command of Vizalma, and that was that. It's all very matey.
Told lies about what you were able to do, you mean?
That's right. Mind you, I'd been doing it, I suppose, by that time, for about 2.5 years or something like that. So I'd had a fair amount of experience.
Were you glad to be skipper?
Oh, yes, it was great fun. Oh, it was marvellous. And we had a very good crowd on board. We had five officers and 55 crew. And just to give you some idea about what the ship was like, we had a 4-inch gun. We had a Bofors anti-aircraft gun, which was quite a big thing on the foredeck. We had twin .5 anti-aircraft guns on the stern, and Oerlikons on either wing. So we had two Oerlikons. And then, of course, the main armament was depth charges. We carried, I suppose, 100 depth charges or something like that, which were either in rails on the stern, where you just roll them off the stern, and then you had throwers, two throwers on either side, which threw, they were like a little gun, in effect. And this shot the depth charge out probably about 100 yards on either side of the ship. So you could, in fact, then form a pattern, rolling them off the stern, then the ones that were thrown out on either side, and then you drop some more a bit farther on, so that the U-boat, if you got one, was in the middle of this this pattern.
So you said you were doing this work in the Eastern Atlantic.
Yeah.
And what happened next to you?
Well, we did that for a long time, and in fact, I did that the whole time that I was in command of Vizelma. As I said earlier, they rang the changes for us. We used to go to Iceland fairly frequently. We went up to the Faroes. I can't remember why we went to the Faroes, but we went to the Faroes. We then go down to Gib. We went down and we took over the Azores with the army, I suppose, and air force when they were going to build the big aerodrome at Ponta Delgada, I think it was, in the Azores. And we were there for quite a while, just patrolling while they were building this aerodrome. And then after that, they used to slip in the odd trip to Russia, which was probably the most significant part as far as I personally was concerned. Certainly it's the most memorable.
Can you tell me what happened on your first trip to Russia?
Well, we went the first time. We went up in. I'm not sure whether it was the date. I went up twice. One was in the summer when, of course, it was daylight the whole time. The other one was in the winter when it was dark the whole time. And the first time I went was in the summer, and we were going up quite happily, and we then started having air raids when significant numbers of bombers and torpedo bombers came in from Norway, and. There was the convoy that we were with was an interesting one, because in the middle of it was a Russian icebreaker called the Krasin. And the Krasin was a very famous ship in Russia. It had been an icebreaker operating in the Arctic. And it had been the ship that rescued the Italian Nobili, or however he pronounces his name, who was the Italian who tried to reach the North Pole by airship, and he crashed. And the Russians had to send somebody up to pick him up, and it was the Krasin that was sent to pick him up, which it did. That's a bit of a digression. But on this occasion, she'd been having a refit in America, and came back loaded, like all the ships that were going to Russia, with tanks and motor vehicles and airplanes and this, that and the other. And but I think one of the things that they'd done to the Krasin had given her an enormous armament, largely of anti-aircraft guns. And she was in the middle, right in the middle of the convoy. And it was terribly funny. When we had these air raids, the Krasin let fly with everything. And they were very low. And you could almost see the poor old merchantman saying, you know, don't hit me, because all the Krasin, you could see it, because a lot of it was tracers. How the ships weren't hit by the Krasin, I don't know. But anyway, that was an interesting thing. We then had one of the ships in front of us, called the Jutland, was sunk. And it was a fairly gentlemanly sort of sinking, in that they were able to get away in boats. And these boats then came alongside, and we picked them up. And in one of these were three slightly non-nautical looking people, shall we say. And when they came aboard, it turned out that they were the British mission to Kuibyshev, which was where the Russian government had moved out to. And the leader of this mission was Sir John Lawrence, and he had two other people with him. And I had a rating who was taking the names of all the people as they came over the side. And John Lawrence came over the side, and this bloke said to him, "And who are you?" And he said, "My name's Lawrence, and I'm a diplomat." And this bloke said, "As far as I'm concerned, you're just a fucking survivor." And so that was just a good laugh. After the war, old Lawrence, this is again digressing, after the war, Lawrence wrote a lot of books. And I made contact with him again in about 1992 or something like that. When he had joined the Russian Convoy Club, and he got my address from the book. So he sent me a copy of one of his books, which was on Lawrence of Lucknow, which was one of his forebears. And he'd endorsed it at the beginning to John Engelbeck for one of his fucking survivors. So he'd remembered it as well. Anyway, we picked them up, and we had some pretty hilarious days between then and Murmansk, where we left them, and that was that.
Why hilarious?
Well, I mean, they were good value, you know, and we used to have some good laughs, and they'd tell us this, that, and the other. I mean, it was, and there was nothing much to do, you know. I mean, in those days, it was either everything or nothing. When there was nothing happening, we used to play chess and do various things like that, you know. I mean, it was a fairly quiet affair. But then when we got to Russia, and this applied on both the... I'll come back to the winter one later. No, it'd probably be better if I do that as well. We then got to Russia with these survivors, and they were all landed. We stayed there for about 6 weeks, being bombed fairly regularly, because the German air base was only about 20 miles away, and they used to come over with great regularity and bomb us. We were there just waiting for about 6 weeks in order to come back. Well, the Russians were absolutely impossible. They wouldn't allow anything. You couldn't do anything. You couldn't go anywhere. They were most unhelpful. We were not on very good terms with them at all. I'll switch now and leave Murmansk for the moment until I've told you about the other convoy I went up in, which was JW-51B, which was one of the more famous convoys, because this was the senior officer of the escort was Sherbrooke, and we were going up, and it was winter, and so it was very, very dark. And in Vizalba, we didn't have any radar in those days, so at night you just had your own just your eyes to rely on, and we were alongside two big American merchantmen, and so we said, well, we'll just stay firmly alongside here. Well, we had a hell of a gale, and the morning after the gale finished, you could just see, I mean, there was a loom, you know, you could see a bit by about 10 o'clock, between about 10 and 12. And we were still with these two merchantmen, but there was no one else around anywhere. But bearing in mind that there were only, I think from memory, about 20 ships in the convoy, and I'd got two of them, I reckon I'd probably got a fair percentage of the convoy. So we just went on, more or less in the on the course that we'd been steering before, we didn't worry too much. And then we had another night, and we lost one of these Americans during the night. I don't know what happened to her. And I never even knew what her name was. But we then woke up the following morning to find ourselves just with this big merchantman called the Chester Valley. And so we stooged along quite happily. We were all, it was about sort of 10 o'clock in the morning, I suppose. And we were all chipping ice, because in those days, in the winter, if you didn't keep your superstructure clear of ice, it would build up and build up, and there was every probability that you'd turn over. So everybody, all hands were out chipping ice, and I was on the foredeck, and I had a Canadian officer of the watch, and he suddenly yelled down, there's some flashing on the starboard beam. So I looked out on the starboard beam to see what this flashing was, and it was quite apparent that it wasn't signal flashing, it was gunfire, because the whole, there were...